I have a little bit to read from the bestseller here. And I'm going to read in James 1. And I'm going to start in verse 22. Wow, you guys are cheerful. I'm going to start in verse 22 and read to the end of that chapter. But don't just listen to God's word. You must do what it says. Otherwise, you are only fooling yourselves. For if you listen to the word and don't obey, it's like glancing at your face in the mirror. You see yourself, walk away, and forget what you look like. But if you look carefully into the perfect law that sets you free, and if you do what it says, and don't forget what you heard, then God will bless you for doing it. If you claim to be religious but don't control your tongue, you're fooling yourself, and your religion is worthless. Pure and genuine religion in the sight of God the Father means caring for orphans, widows, their distress, and refusing to let the world corrupt you.
Good morning, church. What version was that, Dave? The Easy for Dave version, you said? All right, New Living, I like that. You must not just listen to the word, we must do what it says. Right after the song by Ryan, a thank you, it's a good day. I hope that, I hope you agree. If you don't, I'm still going to have a good day, so it's on you. It's wonderful to be here, and as Jim so eloquently said, we're going to start out the way that we pretty much always have. With our memory verse, you already know it because he already said what it was, John 14. It's verses 6 and 7. And tell you what, I'll just put it on the board today and let's recite it all together. Jesus said to them, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Let's bow in a word of prayer before we get going this morning. Holy Father, we have so much to say thank you for. We have so much to be able to do. and we have so much that we look back and look in our front of our lives and even look to the future and know that it's from your blessing. I pray, Lord, as we open your word now and as your servant gets up here to talk, I pray that the words are not empty but filled with you. Not because it's from me, but because I pray that I can just talk about your word and let your word speak for itself. And may your word and may your spirit here this morning impact every single heart and every single mind, not just now, but through today as we exit these doors, tomorrow as we return to work, Tuesday as we kind of get a little bit farther from the assembly and start dealing with the world again, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, all the way back around to the next time that we can come here and assemble and encourage one another to love and good deeds. We know that, God, you are capable, and I pray we are willing. It's all this we ask in your Son's name. Amen. It's good to see you once again. It's good to see all of you. I was telling Angela the last couple days we've had a little bit harder time getting out of the house, and you just feel kind of behind, you know, getting out of the house. Anyone relate? It's you, empty nesters, you. But once we get into service and once we get here, it's good to be here. And I'm trying to I'm doing something psychological for me. I'm trying to very gently settle in so I don't talk really fast, because I'm in one of those moods when I get stressed out, I tend to talk really fast. So I'm letting myself settle in, also being sincere though. But also, I do just want to say this. I meant to say this last week, and I've said it before, but I do just want to say it again. Isn't it marvelous whenever we get interrupted by the sound of a crying kid? It's awesome. And it's just, I want to say this to reassure you. I don't want to single anyone out, but I wanted to say this to reassure you, at least for me, all you parents out there, and myself included, because I hear my own kids, and I go, it's wonderful. It's wonderful if I get interrupted by the sound of a child, because it means there's children here. It means that the church has a future. It means that there's parents here who are willing to come with their children, which is no small feat. Empty nesters, you know that. And it's just awesome. And if we are truly a family, it's not right without the sound of a child. And so thank you all for that, and thank you all you parents, my wife included, for being here and doing what you do. I'm glad I can count on my son for an immediate illustration. It's all good. He will be a preacher one day. I want to tell you the story that you may be familiar with. That's awesome. I want to tell you the story that you may be familiar with. Speaking of sons and fathers, some of you may know this story, some of you may not. But if nothing else, you know, kind of bear with us, so bear with me and we'll get to the point. There was once a young man who had gone to one of the best colleges in the United States. And he was a bit of an arrogant young fellow, but did well in his classes and was able to graduate with honors and you know, had a few friends, had kind of his social clique, but his teachers all noticed that he was a little bit arrogant, very sure of himself, and just a little bit, they were a little bit worried, not for his academics, but worried just about his life outlook. And so they dug into his family a little bit, and eventually the dean of the college called him into his office, and the young man was like, well, I wonder what's going on. But he went in very confident, of course, and he came in and sat down, and the dean of the college sat across from him and said, son, I just want you to tell you congratulations on your near graduation. Congratulations on your grades. Congratulations on your education. And the guy says, thank you very much. And the dean leaned forward in his chair and asked him, out of curiosity, how have you paid for this? And the man goes, well, my father's paid for it all. And that's right, too, because I'm going to do some great things. And the dean says, I'm sure you will. Son, he said, graduation is this Saturday, but I want you to do me a favor, and your graduation depends on it. He says, I want you to go home and hold your father's hand. And the son, the college graduate, was a little bit, thought that was a little bit odd. He hadn't held his father's hand that he could remember in decades, but he said, my graduation depends on this. And the dean said, yes, your graduation depends on this. So that day he went home, surprised his mom in the kitchen, who immediately made him a sandwich and a drink, as wonderful mothers do. And he said, well, where's dad? And mom said, he'll be at home from work shortly. After an hour or two, the dad comes in and he's covered. He's filthy from his work. Can barely see his eyes. Walks in the dust cloud. His boots go off and they're full of mud and dust. And he's surprised to see his son. And he goes, son, what are you doing here? And he says, dad, before you say anything else, can I have your hand? And the father, not being the most emotional man, thought it odd, but gave him his hand. And there was silence for about a minute. The son gave his father a hug and said, thank you. They enjoyed the rest of the evening and went back to college. Right before the graduation, the dean asked the son, what did you see? What did you find? And the son said, my father's hands were so worn, were so calloused, were so wrinkled, were so beaten up by paying for my college. And the son looked down at his hands and said, these hands have never seen a day's work, but my dad has worked every day of his life so I could be here now. And the dean goes, son, you've graduated. The point of that story is, in order for a callus to form, it either is from two ways. It's either from a repeated action, or it's from resisting something. Either way, it's from something happening over and over and over. Now, I've shaken some of your hands in this congregation. Looking at you, Dave. Looking at you, Kurt. Looking at a couple of the people, Jim. You can tell you work with your hands. I'm not, you know, saying anything, but you can tell when you have had repeated action upon something. When I started playing the guitar when I was 6 years old, and by the time I was in high school, a solid near decade later, my fingertips had visible calluses on them because just of pressing the guitar string. When you first start out, you know, because you're pressing steel, you know, it hurts. But eventually you build up a callus. The unfortunate thing is that since I went to the Air Force, and that was almost 10 years now later, I've barely played. So I picked it up the other day, and the first thing I said was, ow, because the calluses go away if you don't use them. But regardless, in order for something to be calloused, as I said, you have to, in the best case scenario, it's from doing something good over and over and over and over and over and over. At the worst case scenario, it's from resisting something over and over and over. The resistance is like whenever you have a blister on your shoe and the shoe's resisting your foot moving forward, and it's not a good thing, but you get a blister and eventually you get a callous. As I said, at very least, it's from the repeated action over and over and over. I'm going to bring this together later, but I want you to be thinking on this question. Is your Christian life calloused? That's a very interesting way to look at it. But look at it from the two ways that I said. Is your Christian life calloused, meaning that you are able to do something over and over and over because you've practiced and done it, or is it calloused because you've been resisting doing it? We'll come back to that in just a minute. If you look at the text here today, in James is a very interesting book. Anyone familiar with Martin Luther's assessment of James? Well, he called it an epistle of straw. Well, the reason was is that it didn't contain any of the big gospel messages like Paul or the Gospels did. But actually, there was another scholar a couple centuries later, who said James may not have the content about the Master. This is Dormy Hayes. But James speaks most like the Master than any other New Testament writer, which I think is a wonderful way to look at this book. And Martin Luther eventually came around on James, by the way. Something you don't hear all the time. He called it epistle of straw, but then he said, okay, it's all right. But regardless, if you look at chapter 1, you have one of the most famous verses in the Bible. Actually, let's not even talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about James for a second. I got ahead of myself. James, we think the writer of this was the half-brother of Jesus. Now, there's a couple of very interesting things about James. One, as far as we can tell, he was not a very devout, if at all, a follower of his brother while on earth. In fact, he was part of the family of Jesus that kind of said, you know, he's basically paraphrased, Thomas Revised Version, he's kind of crazy and we don't really know what to do with him. But eventually, Paul writes that James was part of the crowd that Jesus appeared to in Galatians 16, and 1 Corinthians 15 and Galatians 3. From that, somewhere along the line, James became a great church leader. He had a prominent voice in the council in Jerusalem about circumcision in Acts 15, and obviously he had enough influence to write this book. In fact, James became such a church leader, had such a reputation, that he was rumored to have giant calluses on his knees from the amount of time he spent on them in prayer. Traditionally, James was martyred by being thrown off a high place of the temple and then beaten once he landed. Martyr for the faith. But he wrote this book. We think it was one of the first epistles written, which would put it probably in the late 40s, maybe early 50s, latest. Some interesting things about this book is that you're right, or Luther was right, a lot of people were right. He doesn't talk about the gospel of Jesus so much as he does what to do about it. And what's interesting, too, is that he talks almost exclusively to Jewish Christians. He doesn't mention Gentiles very much. It's all Jewish Christians, which is very interesting because at this time, he starts out the book by saying to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, greetings. This is late 40s, early 50s. The Jews are at a very critical time in their religion. You see, the Jews were the promised people of God for ever before now. And they still are, but now it has morphed into something else. It has been fulfilled, the Jews and everything else has been fulfilled into the gospel of Jesus Christ, fulfilled in the practice of Christianity. They're at a very integral time because the dispersion, those who were spread out from Jerusalem, were now trying to figure out a couple things. They were trying to figure out how to live and act as Christians, not just as Jews, which included getting together, as we established this morning from Ephesians, getting together with Gentiles and pagans and all the other people that they for centuries had looked down upon. But they were also, simply like the early church, trying to figure out what it meant to be a Christian. We're still figuring out, as a matter of fact, but that's another story. In James chapter 1, he starts out very, very hard-hittingly, right in the tone of Jesus. And almost everyone knows the second verse of James. Consider it all joy. Some translations say pure joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. Now, a lot of people read that and they kind of have this reaction. Your face when you read James 1:2. Because you go, why? Do I have to? Well, it's actually all for a very interesting point. He starts out counting out pure joy when you encounter trials of various kinds. And to these people, he was basically saying, you're going to encounter trials. You might as well be happy about it. Not might as well, you should be happy about it, because these trials are going to produce perseverance and character. And he says, while you're in the middle of trials, if any of you lack wisdom, which who lacks wisdom on any given day, ask God and He will give it to you generously. Now, out of that wisdom, don't get too haughty, because let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation. He's basically saying that when you're going through these trials, even if you're asking wisdom, remember your place in Christianity. He gets right into the structure of Christianity, which is on its head from the world. The world says if you are rich, you better let people know you're rich and all that. Christianity says quite the opposite. If you're rich, it's better to let no one know it. In fact, it's not even, you should not let your left hand know what your right hand's doing with it. And he says, exalt the lowly brother. But why? He says in verse 12, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life. This is what this is going for. He says, how you respond to these trials, how you respond in your wisdom with these, how you respond, how you act, what you do about this will determine many things about your Christian walk. And he talks about how sin is not something necessarily we deal from the outside, but how in the process of all this, sin is something that creeps up from the inside. We don't have time. I'm not going to go over the whole chapter. Just telling you kind of what's going on up until verse 22. He says in verse 16, even though you're going through this in the context, be assured that even though you will deal with sin, even though you will have these struggles about how to act and how to live, every good and perfect gift, verse 16 and 17, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, from whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. He says, whenever there is something in your life which is not so good, that you have to deal with, you have to make effort to deal with in a Christian manner, know that God didn't necessarily send it to you. Anything bad He wouldn't send it to you. He'll let you deal with it because He wants you to produce character like Christ. Out of this, verse 19, my beloved brethren, here we go. This is kind of gets in exactly what we're talking about today. Let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. Offhand, we have a little bit of contrast here. He says, you must do something about what you know. In this case, he's talking about anger. He's talking about filthiness. He's talking about how you react. Which, who here has ever reacted maybe kind of poorly whenever you encounter trials? We can't relate to this at all, can we? It happened to me just the other week. Something happened. It was not anything that I did or didn't do, but it happened. It caused stress in my life, and my first reaction was anger, and I hated it, if I can say that. I was angry that I was angry more than anything else. I'm like, why am I reacting this way? But he says, you must do something about it. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word. He says, you must let the word of God speak to you and then have that do something about your actions. Finally, here is what we're talking about this morning. Verse 22, and I have the ESV. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is the hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like. And I find this illustration to be very, very interesting. Who here has ever woken up and maybe you have to use the restroom, and you go in and you turn the light on, and your first reaction in the morning when you go into the bathroom is, ah! For some of you it might be, hey, but mostly it's, ah! The illustration I have in this that I want to try to kind of flesh out a little bit here is, imagine is if you went and you had the huh reaction, then as soon as you looked away, you forgot all about that. Your reaction dictated that you needed to do something about what you saw. Yes? People later on in your day might agree with you. But the thing is, what James is saying is that knowledge of something is good, is necessary, is part of the equation. But it's only the very beginning, and it's a very incomplete part, because unless you understand something and then do something about it, what's he say actually? Let's continue on for a second. But the one who looks... this is neat. The one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, will be blessed in his doing. Check this out. If anyone thinks he is religious, anytime the New Testament talks and uses the word for religious, it's usually not a good thing. It's kind of a rebuke. Anyone who thinks he is religious, yet does not bridle his tongue, understands that maybe he needs to, but does not actually do it, deceives his heart. This person's religion is worthless. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. We've been going over this series last couple weeks that I called Christianity Isn't for Everyone. It'll be up on the website this week if you want to go back and review it. Hopefully it was worth something to someone. But the main point of that series was the fact that in Jesus and Nicodemus' conversation, Nicodemus only saw the physical manifestation of Jesus and didn't actually see the kingdom, didn't actually see the godly realm, didn't actually believe that, and because of that could only know so much, and therefore could only do so much. And we ended last week with the thought, and this was, I got some interesting comments on this one, we ended with the thought that Christianity wasn't for everyone, only those who, remember? Believed it. And we talked about how that word believe doesn't just mean to know and understand, but actually to act out in faith. Believe is close to the word for faith in the Bible, and faith, it comes from evidence, and if you really believe something, you'll actually act on evidence. That's where we ended last week, and I want to continue basically that thought from another epistle. James is saying the exact same thing. He's saying that you can understand all you want. You can understand that you have to bridle your anger. You can understand that you have to be slow to speak. You can understand that you need to do some work in the morning. You can understand all these things. You can know it all you want. But basically he says it very, very plainly. He says, but unless someone actually acts on that understanding, actually does something from it, what does he call that person's religion? He calls it worthless. Let's get personal for a second here. I speak a lot of words. I do. From the pulpit and otherwise, but that's another story. I have a degree in Bible. I know a few things. If I preach to you over and over and over, but yet didn't actually listen to what I preached, what would you think I am? Worthless. You can say it. I'd be worthless. We have Sunday school. I call it Sunday school, but I don't know why. We have Bible study, whatever you call it. We get together and study the Bible on Sunday morning. We're getting some good things. I mean, Alan just finished Acts. I'm doing Ephesians. We're getting into a class is usually when we can really take it and really chew on the meat and have some ideas that maybe challenge some things. But my question to you is this, and I actually might ask this to you. What have you learned from Acts? Might be able to answer that. What have you learned so far from Ephesians? Hopefully be able to answer that. My next question is much more important. What are you doing about it? Church, my first kind of semi-quasi point, which leads to the next thing, is that we can Bible study all we want. We can read Scripture all we want. And should we? Absolutely yes. Absolutely yes. We have to be able to have the knowledge. We have to have the understanding. We have to have that foundation. Plus, I mean, a lot of awesome, crazy things happen when you read Scripture. You don't always understand it all the time, but yet stuff happens. But here's the thing. Whether you're a preacher, whether you're a shepherd, whether you're a whatever, whether you're an architect, whether you're an engineer, whatever you are, if you're in the church, whatever knowledge we have is as worthless as the man who gets up and forget what he looks like if we don't do anything about it. How many people in this room, and don't answer this, well, if you want, we'll have a prayer for you. How many people in this room in your life have known that you have to forgive someone, and you somehow never get around to calling them, sending them a letter, finding them again? How many of you have never acted on that knowledge? I have. Just the other week. How many of you have known that someone is in trouble? Have known that someone needs something and yet you've done nothing about it? Now, I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm not saying anything about... Stuff happens. It's not always our fault. But here's the thing. We have to be aware of this. That we can know something. And unless we couple it with action, it's worthless. You want the biggest example? How many people out there, meaning the rest of the world, not saying in here is perfect, but how many people out in the world know that Jesus claims to be the way, the truth, and the life? Most of them. What is their spiritual condition? I have a video which I want to show you. It's 5 or 6 minutes long, and we'll finish up after this, but I think this really illustrates the main point. This isn't the main point, believe it or not. This is to get you convicted to accept the main point, just to let you know my logic. How many of you in here can ride a bike? Actual show of hands. Ride a bicycle. Not shaming you if you don't, it's okay. I haven't for a while, so I'm in the maybe category. But check this out, and then we'll talk about it in, maybe, in just a minute. Go for it, Jordan.
Hey, it's me, Destin. Welcome back to Smarter Every Day. You've heard people say it's just like riding a bike, meaning it's really easy and you can't forget how to do it, right? But I did something. I did something that damaged my mind. It happened on the streets of Amsterdam, and I got really scared, honestly. I can't ride a bike like you can anymore. Before I show you the video of what happened, I need to tell you the backstory. Like many six-year-olds with a MacGyver mullet, I learned how to ride a bike when I was really young. I had learned a life skill, and I was really proud of it. Everything changed, though, when my friend Barney called me 25 years later. Where I work, the welders are geniuses, and they like to play jokes on the engineers. He had a challenge for me. He had built a special bicycle, and he wanted me to try to ride it. He had only changed one thing. When you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. When you turn it to the right, the wheel goes to the left. I thought this would be easy, so I hopped on the bike, ready to demonstrate how quickly I could conquer this.
And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Destin Sandlin. First attempt riding the bicycle.
All right. So, the faster I go, the better.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't do it. You can see that I'm laughing, but I'm actually really frustrated. In this moment, I had a really deep revelation. My thinking was in a rut. This bike revealed a very deep truth to me. I had the knowledge of how to operate the bike, but I did not have the understanding. Therefore, knowledge is not understanding. Look, I know what you're probably thinking. Destin's probably just an uncoordinated engineer and can't do it. But that's not the case at all. The algorithm that's associated with riding a bike in your brain is just that complicated. Think about it. Downwards force on the pedals, leaning your whole body, pulling and pushing the handlebars, gyroscopic precession in the wheels, every single force is part of this algorithm. And if you change any one part, it affects the entire control system. I do not make definitive statements that often, but I'm telling you right now, you cannot ride this bicycle. You might think you can, but you can't. I know this because I'm often asked to speak at universities and conferences, and I take the bike with me. It's always the same. People think they're going to try some trick, or they're just going to power through it. It doesn't work. Your brain cannot handle this. For instance, this guy. I offered him $200 just to ride this bike 10 feet across the stage. Everybody thought he could do it.
No, you didn't understand. So, this way. Alright, whatever you're in.
Wait.
No, you have to keep your feet on. Alright,
here we go. Wait, you gotta start rolling at least. And go.
Keep your feet on the pedal. Go. Yep, one. All right, one more time.
Once you have a rigid way of thinking in your head, sometimes you cannot change that, even if you want to. So here's what I did. It was a personal challenge. I stayed out here in this driveway, and I practiced about 5 minutes every day. My neighbors made fun of me. I had many wrecks, but after 8 months, this happened. One day I couldn't ride the bike, and the next day I could. It was like I could feel some kind of pathway in my brain that was now unlocked. It was really weird, though. It's like there's this trail in my brain, but if I wasn't paying close enough attention to it, my brain would easily lose that neural path and jump back onto the old road it was more familiar with. Any small distractions at all, like a cell phone ringing in my pocket, would instantly throw my brain back to the old control algorithm, and I would wreck. But at least I could ride it. My son is the closest person to me genetically, and he's been riding a normal bike for 3 years. That's over half his life. I wanted to know how long it would take him to learn how to ride a backwards bike, so I told him if he learned how to ride a backwards bike, he could go with me to Australia and meet a real astronaut. Are you going to give up?
No.
Go ahead. This is how it starts. Look at this. This is such a big deal. Get up. You got it. Did you see his brain get it? So he, in how many weeks have we been doing this? 2 weeks? In 2 weeks, he did something that took me 8 months to do, which demonstrates that a child has more neuroplasticity, am I even saying that right, than an adult. It's clear from this experiment that children have a much more plastic brain than adults. That's why the best time to learn a language is when you're a young child. All right, today's bike log. I can ride smooth, I can ride fast. I'm thinking the experiment is over. Okay, now I'm in Amsterdam, a city that has more bicycles than people. The question is, can I ride a normal bike now? I mean, I've spent all this time unlearning how to ride a bike. If I go back and try to ride a normal one, will my brain mess up? So I've tweeted a Smarter Everyday meetup, if you will, and I'm going to see if somebody brings a bicycle, and I'm going to try to ride a normal bike.
It's backwards. It's backwards.
This was one of the most frustrating moments of my life. I had ridden a normal bike since I was 6, but in this moment, I couldn't do it anymore. I had set out to prove that I could free my brain from a cognitive bias. But at this point, I'm pretty sure that all I've proved is that I can only redesignate that bias.
So what you're not seeing is just a group of people here looking at me, looking at the strange American that can't ride a bike because they think I'm dumb. But I'm actually 2 levels deep into this because I've learned and unlearned. All right.
After 20 minutes of making a fool out of myself, suddenly my brain clicked back into the old algorithm. I can't explain it, but it happened in a very specific moment.
Got it. I'm back.
Yep.
Oh, click. Hold it, click.
I got it.
Okay, there it is. There's the moment. Good. Okay, I can ride a bike.
I tried to explain this to the people around me, and they just didn't get it. They thought I was faking the previous 20 minutes, and I couldn't get anybody to believe me.
That looked like I faked that, didn't it?
Yeah.
Just a face.
Yes.
You think I'm faking. You don't believe me.
This is so weird. You're like, la, la, and it's
you think I'm lying, don't you?
Yeah, I
don't. I'm not lying.
I felt like the only person on the planet who had ever unlearned how to ride a bike, and I couldn't articulate it to anyone because everybody just knew that you can't forget how to ride a bike. So I learned 3 things from this experiment. I learned that welders are often smarter than engineers. I learned that knowledge does not equal understanding. And I learned that truth is truth, no matter what I think about it. So be very careful how you interpret things, because you're looking at the world with a bias, whether you think you are or not. I'm Destin. You're getting smarter every day. Have a good one.
Next time someone says, it's just like riding a bike, you go, you can laugh. Why did I show you that video? Well, because it illustrates something, the next step from action. Let's say that we have understood something, and let's say that we have put it into action. Or, to go back to my opening point, resisted that action and built up a callus either way. Let me ask you this question. When I say that Christians should serve, what do you think of? A lot of people may think of serving here. Some people said, I didn't hear what you said. But regardless, a Christian serving, which is putting into action their faith in some way, shape, or form, I'll give you a spoiler. Honestly, here's not really that pressing. Now, it's good. There are gifts for the sake of the church to build each other up and such. But remember what the church is, yes? The church is everywhere and all the time, meaning the church is the people. There are days I show up here And I've been gifted with preaching and teaching, well, somewhat, preaching and gifting. There are some days where your service, I don't necessarily need, but someone does. There are days we show up and it happened to me actually 3 weeks ago just about. I showed up here and I went straight to the three people that encouraged me most because I knew that they would encourage me. Sometimes you need it. Sometimes you don't. But when I say service, that Christians should serve, also based off Ephesians 4 this morning, sometimes we get so caught up in serving at service that we forget that faith-filled action is most seen among the faithless. We can appreciate people who have gifts, song leading gifts, prayer gifts. We can appreciate, you know, people encouraging. And this is a place where we need to exercise those gifts when we need to. I mean, this is what the assembly is supposed to be, to encourage each other and to spur each other on to love and good deeds. I mean, that's what this is here for. But at the same time, it cannot end or be limited to here. And I think all of us would agree with that. And if you agree with that, here is my next question. How have you learned to serve? My next question then is there something you need to unlearn? And is there something else you need to relearn? When it comes to action, this is kind of the same thing as when you wake up in the morning and you see yourself and you do, and you, when you come here and serve, it's awesome and it's great and God is praised and we all appreciate it. Don't hear me say that that's not a bad thing. But are you serving in that way to someone who needs to see it? Are you serving in that way when you exit this building? Are you serving in that way outside of the assembly? Are you serving in that way among people who don't understand why you would serve in that way? If you are not, I think I know why. It has the same principle to do with the bike. We get so conditioned to only turning on our spiritual gifts here at the assembly that we have learned sometimes not to serve in that way in the world. We get so rigid. Did you catch what he was saying? Adults can be so rigid in their thinking. And that was the whole thing about the bike. He had to unlearn the rigidity of learning how to ride a bicycle the normal way to do it the other way. And then he had to relearn back. Sometimes we get so caught up in doing something a certain way that we forget to apply it in every other way we need to. Sometimes we learn something in a context and forget that that thing, that gift, is universal. Sometimes we get so caught up in doing something one way, doing church, and I don't use this word very often, I hate that term because we are the church. Sometimes we get so caught up in doing church that we turn off our spiritual gift mindedness when we exit this building. How many of you in this room wouldn't, if someone came up and said, hey, would you pray for me? Or, hey, this is going on in my life. How many of you in this building would go, let me pray for you? And you might even do it right away. Hopefully, most of you. How many of you, whenever you hear a Walmart cashier say, this is going on in my life, you go, I'm sorry. What's the difference? Would they look at you funny? Maybe. Would people notice? Yeah. Do we need to unlearn that way of thinking and learn that our faith possibly is better spoken of when we act in a Christian way, act out of what we know among non-Christians than when we're with Christians? You see what I'm saying? I'm not going to quite call it worthless. But there are a lot of people in this world who would call it that because that's what they see. They see the church getting together on Sunday morning and going, hey, good job, we love Jesus. And then they go out into the world and you can't tell them apart. We've all been guilty of this. Don't think that you're the only one who's guilty in this. We've all been guilty of it. We've all done things or laughed at things or had moments. I mean, this is not a guilt trip, all right? Hopefully this is a conviction trip for me too. And I'm the preacher. I mean, I do it too. I did it just the other day. There's a woman at Walmart. Let me confess for a minute. There's a woman at Walmart who just had a baby. And I know her name's Ariel. Who just had a baby. And I noticed that she had an engagement ring on. She just had a baby. And I noticed that every time that she serves, she has a cannot sell alcohol sign by her cashier, which means she's under 21. Now, she's 21. You're going to think I'm a stalker. No, I'm not. I notice things like this. She's under 21, had the baby, and is engaged. I think she would be someone I would offer premarital counseling to. You know what? I saw her the other day for the first time in weeks. And I blew it. I even went to her line, for goodness sakes. I went to her line and I walked outside and I went, oh. It happens, okay? So don't feel guilty. This is the point of being here, so we can say, hey, I'll pray for you. Let me go with you next time and do it. This is what we're here for. So the point of this is, the whole point of this lesson, is sometimes we have been calloused to act in ways that are not necessarily good. Or the best. Sometimes we are calloused in our Christian walk in ways that we're resisting knowing how to act. My challenge to you today is this. Pick something. Pick someone. Pick somewhere to serve in your giftedness, to serve in somewhere you can do, and build up a callous to it. What I mean by that is do it so much that you don't even think about it. Whenever I was at the height of my guitar playing and I had calluses on my fingers that helped me do it, I could play for hours and I wouldn't think, you know, anything of it. I'd be like, yeah, let's keep going. Now I play for 2 minutes and my fingers hurt for a day. Are we like that with our Christian gifts? We do it and we feel awkward about it and we go, it's kind of weird. I don't know if I want to do that again. Well, you know how to get over that? You keep doing it. You keep acting in faith. You get through the awkward looks. You get through the people going, you're weird. And you go, I'd be weird for Jesus. It's all good. And you build up a callous to it. In your bulletins today, if you don't have one, there's some in the back. I've given you a sheet that kind of looks like this. Some of you may have seen it and went, what am I supposed to do with this? Here's what I challenge you to do. You can pick all three of these or you can pick one. It's up to you. But I want to challenge you this week to work on turning your faith, your understanding, into action, and to make an intentional effort to build up a spiritual callous in the good way of doing something that before long will just come naturally to you. In your first box, I invite you to write a who. Write who, and then in that next line, write someone to serve. I'm not saying they have to not be a Christian. They can be whoever you want. But I invite you, if you really want to grow at this, and this is from my own experience, pick someone where you're not innately comfortable to serve. In the next one, I invite you to write a what. An organization, a place, be able to take something you're gifted in and be able to serve. Understand something and put that into action. And the last bit, I invite you to write a where. Now, this is the interesting one. I invite you not just to write, this was the organization, maybe. Aware is a place where you are, like Walmart, or the park, or walking down the street, downtown Friday nights. I'm not sure what the Bofush Festival is called, I'm sorry. Thursday nights, throw down, something like that. No. This is the where. Because after all, what does the Great Commission say? It says, go. Which means as you are going and make disciples. Put that in another case, go and serve. Go and be a Christian wherever you are. Not all of you will do this. Some will. Regardless though, my two main points are this. If you're a Christian and are not serving, and are not putting your faith into action, I'm not saying it, James is saying it. He's saying your religion is very close to being worthless. And if you are a Christian and want to serve, I invite you today to begin the intentional process of growing your serving. Making a spiritual callous, meaning something you can do so often and without thinking so much that you do so much that you can do it without thinking. Because the thing is, like that father's hands that paid for his son's education, hands and feet that have been used, that have been well used, can pay for a great many viable things in the future. If you do something to someone that you are uncomfortable with, you have no idea. And this sounds idealistic, but it happens. You have no idea. 5 years, 5 months, 5 days, 5 minutes after you leave, what God can do with what you have just done. Church, today I invite you a very simple thing. I invite you to go from your seat into service. Whoever, wherever, and whatever that looks like, I invite you to put your faith into action. And if you want one last reason why we need to act on our faith, it's very simple. Jesus did. Let's stand and sing.